This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca. Welcome to Needs No Introduction, Fresh Ideas from Speakers of Note, a production of Rabble.ca. I'm Victoria Fenner, the executive producer of the Rabble Podcast Network. In this era of so many short-form podcasts, we like to bring you longer pieces which explain some of the context behind some of the world's most pressing issues. And today's no exception. Unless you're an expert on the Israeli occupation of Palestine, it's hard to figure out what's going on when we hear about it on the news. Today's two speakers give some useful background, which I found really helpful in understanding the past, present, and possible futures of that conflict. We have two presentations today, one from Beit Zetun in Toronto at an event called Should We Be Talking About Fascism? With speaker Greg Albo, and an address by Dr. Philip Leach, Senior Fellow for the Center on Government at the University of Ottawa. Both talks were recorded earlier this month. First up, University of Ottawa and Dr. Philip Leach. Dr. Leach is a Senior Fellow for the Center on Government at the University of Ottawa and has taught at both graduate and undergraduate levels at Liverpool, Plymouth, and Exeter Universities. He's written two books, The State of Palestine, A Critical Analysis, and Popular Uprisings in the Middle East. Here's Dr. Philip Leach.
The topic of this talk is Palestine and then the peace process. But I'm hoping that as I talk, you'll be able to see these things from a different, slightly different perspective. And as John said, it draws a lot on my PhD research, which actually became my first book, which is more than my PhD, a lot more. But it draws on, really, the most important thing, it draws on field work, which started in 2007 and went on. I went back last year, 2015. So I'm going to talk a bit about the situation, and then I'm going to move on at the end. I'm going to talk about the ongoing research, what I'm doing now, what I'm going to do next. So we'll start here. In November 2012, does anybody know who this person is here? Yeah, it's Mahmoud Abbas. He's the president of the Palestinian Authority and the chairman of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization. And in November 2012, he was at the United Nations General Assembly, and he was obviously very happy because what had just happened is that Palestine has now been was recognized as a non-member observer state at the UN General Assembly, which is a huge upgrade from what it was before. It was an international organization, effectively, the PLO, with speaking rights at the UN. But this idea of statehood is obviously central to the issue of Palestine. 138 countries voted for the recognition of Palestine as a non-member observer state. 9 voted against, of course, including Israel, the US, and I don't know if anybody remembers the famous speech by John Baird, the then Foreign Minister of Canada, who advocated very strongly against it. 41 countries abstained, including my own wonderful nation of Great Britain, but the resolution was passed overwhelmingly. So what this meant was Palestine didn't get a great deal more out of this. It got no voting rights, but it was equivalent to the Holy See, to Vatican City. So it got the right to speak. It already had the right to speak, but it got formally the right to speak. But the big issue people were concerned about was what this meant to the context of the conflict. It was a bloody nose for Israel and the United States, because they've been trying to advocate for different routes for Palestinian statehood, although they've advocated for it a lot. And they've been trying to resist this a great deal. So that bloody nose for Israel and the United States, and I suppose for Canada too, was a big sort of diplomatic win for the Palestinians. But in the end, this has not made a great deal of difference. When the resolution to recognize Palestinian statehood went to the UN Security Council, which is, if anybody knows, it's the executive body of the United Nations, made up of 15 members, 5 of which are permanent members. Everybody thought that the US was going to have to use its veto, but in fact it lobbied very hard, and they lost the vote, the Palestinians lost the vote, without the US ever needing a veto. So Palestine is again in limbo. It's been in limbo for a long time, but it's in a slightly different kind of limbo. Possibly at this level, at the level of international recognition, an upgraded level of limbo. So what does this mean in reality? Is the Palestinian state a reality now? Well, this opens up a theoretical question for us. What is a state? I'm going to ask you to give me some answers now. I mean, what makes Canada a state?
You need defined borders and a monopoly of force within them.
Defined borders, monopoly of force, yeah.
You need to be
recognized by other states?
Recognized by other states, a much murkier business than you would appreciate.
Some kind of governance.
Okay, governance, yeah. Okay, yeah. Although you could argue that some states we might call failed states have less governance, but it goes with the idea, yeah. But there are other markers you can look. You can look at the dollar bills in your pockets. What's on there? The head of state of Canada. You've got the Queen. You've also got symbols, prime ministers and so on, and great national achievements. National anthem in Canada. You've got all sorts of things. In fact, you've got your own currency here, you know, a national flag. There are all sorts of different markers that you would use to define a state. But we look at what is actually at play in Palestine. You know, no military. Okay, not all states have military. Costa Rica doesn't have a military. Palestine doesn't have a military, and it's occupied by another country, so that's an issue. It's got no currency of its own. It uses the Israeli shekel, the Jordanian dinar, and the US dollar. No control over its territory. This is legally defined under agreements with Israel from the 1990s, but it's also a de facto reality. It's very obvious that the Palestinian Authority, or the Palestinian state as it claims to be, does not control its territory. It has no control over its borders. There's a border with Jordan, which is recognized internationally, which is controlled by Israel. And then, of course, there's the border with Israel, which is controlled by Israel. And in the Gaza Strip, you have a border with Egypt, which is, it is controlled by Egypt, but with Israeli supervision, and it used to have European Union supervision as well before the Israelis kicked them out. And it also has a maritime border. If everybody remembers 2010, the Mavi Marmara was a Turkish ship full of activists, which was intercepted, and 10 people, a Turkish and American citizen, mostly Turks, I think, were killed by Israeli special forces in that operation. So Gaza has no control over its borders at all. Gaza is a special case. It doesn't really have control over much, no control over its airspace, no control over electricity supply, very little control at all. And of course, not recognized by the big players in the international system. As I mentioned, the Security Council, and of course, Israel. Is a very important player when it comes to this. It doesn't seem to have much interest in enforcing or protecting the rights of its own citizens, particularly in the West Bank, but it doesn't really have the ability to, even if it wanted to. It has no control, really, over what happens in Israeli courts, and people can be removed and detained at the drop of a hat. So what's going on here? Because for decades now, American presidents, British prime ministers, Canadian prime ministers, Israeli prime ministers have all been talking about a Palestinian state. This is supposed to be the end of the conflict. We're supposed to have Israel living in peace and security, a Palestinian state, a free Palestinian state. And here's President Obama. The Palestinian people must have the right to govern themselves, to reach their full potential in a sovereign and contiguous state. Well, it's pretty clear, isn't it? So why aren't they accepting this? Why are they not saying, well, that's it now, we've got a state, let's move on? And Obama, of course, is considered the most pro-Palestinian president really there's ever been since, arguably, George H.W. Bush, who was a bit more of a realist. But he's obviously had a lot of very public spats with the Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, yet just last week signed an aid package of $3.8 billion a year for 10 years of military aid towards Israel. So the United States is in a very strange position, argues for a state. When there's a state in the offing, it doesn't accept it. So let's zoom out a little bit here and try and get a grip on this question. What are we really talking about with the Israel-Palestine conflict? And this is the history section, which I'm going to sort of blast through very quickly because we only have a limited amount of time. But let's have a look. There are lots of different answers to this question. People will say it's a 1,000-year conflict between Arabs and Jews. It's about Islam versus Judaism, civilization versus anarchy, barbarism, it's about terrorism, all sorts of things like that. To me, it seems pretty obvious that it's a conflict over territory. And you can see the seeds of it beginning in the 19th century with increasing populations of both Jewish population and the local Palestinian population. This is under the Ottoman Empire. You see this population rising. You have the politicization of migration to Israel with the Zionist movement, which saw the need for an Israeli state in what was then the Ottoman-controlled area of Palestine. The recognition of this by then what followed the Ottoman period, which was the British control in the Balfour Declaration in 1917. And then in the 1930s, a lot of this is really the British imperial power at its most duplicitous, most devious, making promises to all different sides, and they really started to lose a grip on this situation. And in the wake of the Second World War, when the British were bankrupt and had obviously just been fighting in a long war with Germany, they behaved reprehensibly in this situation, cracking down on the local Arab population with the Arab uprising in the 1930s, and then with refugees leaving from Nazi Germany and Nazi-occupied Europe, interning those refugees in concentration camps in Cyprus. But they lost grip of it, really, and they were subject to attacks by both sides. And in 1947, they took the issue to the United Nations, the new United Nations, who offered to partition the land. And in 1948, they were driven out effectively. And then the very next day, Israel was declared, and a war began, which led to the expulsion of lots of Palestinians. So the 1948 war, you can see expulsion of Palestinians who became refugees all over the place. You can see out of Israel into the West Bank and Gaza, and then out into surrounding country. Effectively, the state of Israel is declared on this blue area here. What remains are these areas here, these enclaves. This is the West Bank, which was named by the Jordanians, who controlled it at the time because it was on the west bank of the Jordan River. And this is the Gaza Strip, which remained under control of the Egyptians, who would govern it prior to the war. And Jerusalem, of course, is divided. There's a green line, an armistice line, that runs through the middle of the city. 1967, however, things change again. There's another war, and Israel makes significant territorial gains. It takes over the Sinai Peninsula, takes over the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and also the Golan Heights, which is occupied Syrian territory. There are more wars in 1973. The Egyptians, primarily, and the Israelis fight again. And then in 1979, there is a big change in the diplomatic setup of the region. Egypt signs a peace deal with Israel, recognises Israel, and the Sinai Peninsula is returned to it. And this is a big change from the Israeli perspective, because it begins the normalisation of Israel in the region. Up until that point, Israel existed, of course, in reality, governed Palestinians under military control, and then also under military control in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and was just simply not acknowledged as a state by the rest of the region, essentially. Egypt was then the most important actor in the Arab world. It's, it's a 10,000-year-old civilization. It's a massive country with a huge population. And it had a very big economy at the time, which is declining somewhat. But it was really it was also the heart of pan-Arabism, a sort of a leftist philosophy which had really captured the public attention. And when Anwar Sadat, who was president at the time, acknowledged Israel's existence, it was a huge change in the relationship, both for Egypt with the West and also with Israel with the region. And it began really the change from an Arab-Israeli conflict to a Palestinian-Israeli conflict. When Palestinians started taking control of their own resistance more directly. So what's happened now? These two areas, as I mentioned, are really what we talk about when we refer to Palestine these days. This is the West Bank here, this large area here, and this is the Gaza Strip. And East Jerusalem, of course, is just in here, which is part considered, certainly by international law and by Palestinians, part of the state of Palestine, but considered by Israelis as the unified capital of the state. So these two areas were occupied. And this is a map showing what's called the matrix of control. It's by an Israeli anthropologist called Jeff Halpert, who studied this for years, really, looking at the different levels of control that Israel uses over this area. So what does a military occupation look like? Well, there are various examples. This, as you can see, is the very contentious wall. Some Palestinians will call it the apartheid wall. Israelis call it the separation barrier. Essentially, it's a 10-meter-high wall built to separate the Israeli Jewish population from the Palestinian population, but it doesn't do it very well in the sense that there are lots of Jewish settlers left on the wrong side of the wall and lots of Palestinians left on the wrong side of the wall from the Israeli perspective. And it's also been ruled, the root of the wall has been ruled illegal by the International Criminal Court in 2004 because it's considered a land seizure. And this is another example of checkpoints. This is a common sight you'll see if you get up very early in the morning in the West Bank. You see Palestinians going through this kind of thing to get into Israel to go to work. They used to be much more prevalent throughout the West Bank. There's been a slight decrease over time. So look at some of the human rights concerns there. We've got the separation wall. We've got restrictions on movement. That's not just between Palestine, between the West Bank and Israel, but it's also within the Palestinian territories. Land seizure, not just with the wall, but also with settlements and so on. And these large areas, which the Jordan Valley, the most fertile area in the West Bank, it can be declared closed military zones or nature reserves or whatever. House demolitions, often they're done because of lack of permits. In some cases, sometimes they're done for punitive measures. Arbitrary arrest and detention, lack of border access, of course, you've mentioned, which you think about the knock-on effect of that. Borders don't just mean moving in and out of the country, they mean moving goods in and out of the country. That means trade, that means taxes, that means profit, that means GDP. Division of Hebron, which is the largest city in the West Bank, which is in the south, if you don't count Jerusalem, which is divided between Israeli settlers and a very few number of Israeli settlers and the Palestinians, again by military force, and the closure of Jerusalem, which is essentially divided off from the West Bank. So my research, though, this is the context, this is the big picture. My research really looks at Palestinian politics. Of course, it all happens within this context of what's happening with the Israelis, but I wanted to know what was going on in Ramallah. What's Abbas doing and the former Prime Minister, Salam Fayyad, at the time? He was the Prime Minister at the time. What are they really doing? They make these big waves on the international stage, but what's going on? What's the dynamic between them? What's the relationship between them and the general population? So my research looked at three sites. Nablus City, which is up in the north up there. Balata refugee camp, which is the biggest refugee camp in the West Bank. And two villages. Kariut, which is a relatively large village in the Nablus region, up in the north, and Yanun, which is a tiny little one. 15 families that lived there, and they lived. It was particularly interesting because they lived in this very precarious position in the Jordan Valley, surrounded by settlers. And during the 2000s, this village was completely cleared out of Palestinians by Israeli settlers. So it was a very precarious position that they were in. And I looked at three key themes, really. The security agenda, a development strategy, and the rhetoric of resistance, which I would argue is a pretty empty rhetoric. And I'm looking at these particularly from the outside in. I want to know what's the Palestinian government doing about it, what's their security agenda, what are the international donors who support the Palestinian Authority doing about security, what are they saying and what they're doing, what are they doing about development, saying and doing, and so, and now what is this resistance? Everybody's talking about a state, so and they're talking about ending the occupation. So what is the resistance to the occupation? What does it mean? So let's have a look then at the big picture again. The two-state solution starts in the mid-1990s after the Intifada. The Intifada was literally means the shaking off. It was a popular uprising, unexpected pretty much by everyone, including the Palestinian leadership. It sort of symbolized in the minds of many, particularly on the Palestinian side, by this kind of image. A young boy, completely unarmed, throwing rocks at a tank. What could he possibly hope to accomplish by this? But it took everyone by surprise. And after that, of course, this starts in 1987. What else is happening at the end of the 1980s? End of the Cold War, the Gulf crisis with Iraq, the United States' emergence as the world's only superpower under the leadership of George H.W. Bush, who I said was quite a realist. He was very, very much a pragmatist, I think, in foreign policy, not like his son, was willing to use the tools at his disposal to sort of, arguably, the intention of reshaping the Middle East. Following the Gulf War in 91, there were secret talks amongst diplomats which led to a peace peace talks that happened in Oslo, in Norway, secretly, and then they were revealed in 1993 as in the form of the Declaration of Principles, which set out a new sort of standard for talks between the two sides. This Declaration of Principles was incredibly unbalanced, and a lot of people from the Palestinian perspective would argue that it's effectively a bill of goods, shortchanged. It was poorly negotiated, certainly by the Palestinians, but they were also subject to very much overwhelming pressure from Israel and the United States. This, of course, carried on throughout Bill Clinton's presidency. But the end of this peace process has been three failures, essentially. There's no peace, of course. There's no real state in Palestine, and there's no improvement in basic rights. And in 2000, it all fell apart. There was a second uprising, much more violent than the first, and Israel responded with enormous amount of force, reinvading the West Bank, really making very clear that any gains that are made through any form of negotiations or armed struggle by the Palestinians are reversible because of the overwhelming force available to Israel. Well, this really opened up a new era, a new historic bloc in the sort of Gramscian terminology for the Palestinians. And I would argue, this is really where my research comes into its own. The Palestinian Authority became, after the Second Intifada, became much more authoritarian. And I'm going to look at why and what was going on and what role, importantly, did the international donors who supported it played in this. So a quick timeline here. 2000 to 2007, Second Intifada, there's a disengagement plan from Gaza. That means the settlers who were living in Gaza Strip were removed. Arafat dies and is replaced by Mahmoud Abbas. Hamas, I'm sure you've all heard of Hamas, affiliate of the Muslim Brotherhood, very capable of doing very horrible things, including suicide bombs and all sorts of stuff like that, but also, to some extent, quite pragmatic in their own sort of political way. They'd avoided participating in elections up until 2006, saying that they don't believe in the Palestinian Authority because it was a product of the corrupt peace process. But in 2006, they thought they could win, so they participated and they won. It was a big surprise to everybody, particularly the United States. In response, there was a blockade of aid, which everything really started to fall apart in the West Bank. And then there was a schism, a bit of an armed struggle between the two main factions in Palestinian politics, Hamas on the one hand and Fatah on the other hand. And that led to a territorial division as well as a political division. Gaza fell under Hamas's rule and the West Bank remained under Fatah-dominated Palestinian Authority rule. And this was, by the way, also pretty much the end of democracy in Palestine. There have been no more elections since. There were supposed to be municipal elections this very week, which was put a stop to by the Fatah-dominated Supreme Court, and now they want to run them only in the West Bank, which would of course be won by Fatah. So you can see the democracy's entirely gone out the window. Then 2008, this idea of state building, which we'll talk more about, and then 2012, statehood declared. But I want to argue that the Palestinian Authority was set up to be this interim government that was going to lead to the state of Palestine by the end of 2000s. But as I said, it's been caught up in limbo. But I want to argue that it's not that dissimilar from other governments in the region. In particular, I'm going to draw on Henry and Springborg's term, the bully Praetorian Republic. Effectively, it's a government which uses rent to dispose. Does anybody know what rents are? It's effectively non-competitive contracts that are given out to your friends. It's a pretty legal form of corruption. If you think of tobacco lobbying in the US, or arms, particularly arms manufacturers and their closeness to Congress in the US, people would argue they're a form of rent. They're like, we can do this. We're not going to put it out to competitive bid process. We're just going to give it to the people we trust, which the Palestinian Authority did to enormous effect. They gave lots of money, which they got from international donors, to people they liked and people who were close to them, a pretty solid core of elites. And they also used it to employ the vast, nearly 200,000 people, many of whom had been their allies before they returned to Palestine in the 1990s, were effectively to buy people off, because there's no real private sector in Palestine. There's only a public sector, which is, and the only real secure job is public sector employment, and a lot of it was, about half of that is in the security forces, because it's very easy to give it to people. This is a man we trust. He's going to command this battalion of special whatever guard. He can employ so many hundred people with this, and this takes a lot of people out of poverty, which is a good thing, but it also makes them dependent on the state, and also just shows the weakness of the state. They depend on the state, and the state is dependent on foreign money. So there's the rent aspect, and then the other aspect of that is the use of force. So it's not a democratically elected government with no real legitimacy, and I can show you some data on the legitimacy too. And it's comparable, really, before the Arab Spring, to countries like Tunisia under Ben Ali, or Egypt under Mubarak. You know, people used to call Mubarak the Pharaoh, because he had this complex that he was in government forever, and he would just buy people off. The Saudis is a similar sort of setup. It's a lot of money, which buys people off, and if you can't get bought off, they use force against you. So it's not a democratic approach. And then, of course, there's the neoliberal attitude, which is what the donors would say about this situation, is that resistance is an unfortunate byproduct of economic change. Capitalism requires creative destruction. If you're going to have free markets, which you need to build your country, some people are not going to like it. So this is an unfortunate byproduct. You can see reflections of that rhetoric, not just in Palestine, of course, but all around the world, in Latin America, and then, of course, you can look back to the 1980s in the UK. A lot of public, or just very recently in the UK, with austerity measures and so on. Neoliberalism is about free market, and people don't like it, but they'll get used to it, and it's better for everyone. This is the neoliberal rhetoric. Development is a bitter pill, but it's better for you. And then there's the Marxist critique, which says, actually, it's not about that. It's not a byproduct. It's authoritarianism is the goal. This is about containment, controlling populations. Neoliberalism is a load of rubbish. There is no peace building. There's no state building. This is about keeping people contained. And you can see there's the imperial overtones of that. And you sort of expect that from a Marxist perspective. And there's a very good paper, which I sort of 75% agree with, which is called Peace Building as Counterinsurgency, by a colleague of mine who runs the Kenyan Institute in Jerusalem. Or, this is where it gets murky, maybe it's not a one-size-fits-all explanation. Maybe partly the Marxist critique is correct. Maybe a fraction of the neoliberal approach is correct, and maybe the personal fault of Abbas and so on, the individual decisions is a partly reason. So we'll look at particular causes, and this is where I'm really looking at now, and I want to really go from the data and find out what's going on and let that lead the questioning. So we've got a weak regime. I'm sure you all know the term hegemony. It's confidence and obedience. There's no confidence in obedience, because there's no obedience, and why should there be confidence in it? There's unpopularity, and there's deep-seated structural problems. There's the Israeli strategic envelope, the occupation, which allows very little room for manoeuvre for Palestinian Authority. There's massive levels of poverty. Really astonishing. In some places in the West Bank, it's worse than Gaza. And if you know anything about the situation, you know that's an astonishing reality. There's no economic growth at all. Very little private sector, really, very little private sector at all, which isn't controlled by a few holding groups, and very little entrepreneurship at all. It's also heavily aid dependent. We can look at that. Around $24.6 billion of US aid has been made available to the Palestinian Authority since 1993-2012. And international aid to Palestine has increased 17 times. And if you look at that from the neoliberal perspective, this is building the infrastructure for a state. From a Marxist perspective, this is giving the Palestinian Authority the tools it needs to control the population. But it's certainly a big factor. Let's look at some markets, some indicators, some data now. What's going on? What's happened to all this money? Palestinian Authority, West Bank and Gaza, GDP percentage change over since 2000 to 2012 compared to the rest of the region, the developing countries in the region. You see the Palestinian Authority has been up and down. Guess what, there's a big trough here. 2008, where there's a financial crisis and the West cut back on aid. And then a big boost again in 2009, where they saw it was falling apart, so they paid a lot more aid. 2010, falls down again. 2000, there's no consistency. Fiscal instability. So you've got all these factors that show development's not working, show why the population will be disgruntled. And why then, if you can't, like I described earlier, pay people off to support you, you have to use force to keep them in line. But this is the vicious cycle, really. You've got no growth and no progress. So no economic growth and no progress on the peace process. You've got more and more dependence on foreign aid. The government becomes less and less popular for those two reasons. So it uses more rents, as much as it can, to procure support. And when that starts to fail, it starts to use more violence to ensure stability. And a lot of that foreign aid, of course, went to build the infrastructure of a security state. So what we've seen now is over the past, since 2007, when the Palestinian Authority has been building a state, leading up to declaring a state, you've had the problem that the state is an authoritarian, ineffective, illegitimate, and quite corrupt regime has been compounded. It's been donor-led, it's been strong focus on security. In fact, the security rhetoric has been integrated with the war on terror, which, I don't know if anybody remembers, was pretty popular for a while, with real peaks in violence, particularly in 2007, when that year there were more Palestinians killed by Palestinians than by Israelis for the first time since 1967. That's quite an astonishing thing. More Palestinians killed each other than Israelis killed Palestinians. And in 2011, when the Arab Spring happened, and you've had teetering along from one stumble block to another since then. And then the use of torture, suppression of free speech, and widespread surveillance of political opponents. And this is a great quote from an article that's in Foreign Policy magazine in 2011. A police state is not a state. It's a form of larceny of people's rights, aspirations, and sacrifices for the personal benefit of an elite. So my ongoing research now, arguably a lot of the human rights-centric research, and there's a lot of it about Palestine, really an awful lot, is too atomized. It looks at individual cases. It looks at who's in detention for how long. It tells their story. When it puts it together, it tells you statistics, but it tells you about individual things, how many arrests there are, how many fatalities, how many roadblocks, various different markers of that. What land has been seized, how many house demolitions. This is too atomized. This is too taken apart, because if you look at any of those statistics, you see one set of stories, but you miss the system that's in play. You miss the root causes. The critical approaches, though, go too far to the other end, really. They focus too much on the question of power, which I love. I love the question of power. But they're too abstract. Because if you talk about power, where is power located, which I do in my book a lot, within the Palestinian Authority or within the Israel-Palestine conflict, you sort of lose a grip of these real-world events. And a good example here, if you look at the international involvement, if we go from what we said before, from the Marxist versus neoliberal, you've either got two explanations of what's going on in Palestine. International involvement is always geared towards the pursuit of peace and solutions. And everything you read talks about solutions. Any document you read from the World Bank talks about the need for a two-state solution. And then it doesn't say anything else about it. It then tells you what the problems are. Or the alternative approach is that it's always geared toward the suppression of dissent, which I think there is an element of this, certainly. There's a great book by Lala Khalili, who's at SOAS in London, who really takes a critical look at the notion of state building and counterinsurgency and peace building, a lot of different case studies. And you see there's a very much a correlation between those two in the language they use. But there's also something a bit funny going on, because if the West, in this nebulous term, were so geared towards suppression of dissent in Palestine, why are they so bad at it? Why make such obvious blunders as calling for a Palestinian state and then not allowing it to exist? Or calling for democratic elections in 2006 and then rolling back the results? Why make these absurd blunders? So this answer doesn't really answer it for me either. So what I'm trying to do is bridge that gap at the moment. And as I said, I'm trying to do it from the data and go up from there. So the methodology I'm using is critical discourse analysis. This is pretty boring for you, but the idea is I look at a lot of research and try a lot of existing research and then a lot of policy documents, and I take out key terms, key ideas, code them all thematically, and try and find out what the patterns are And from there, sort of try and map what's going on in the minds of analysts, in the minds of policymakers, importantly. And then I add to that interviews, which I will build on my previous experience with. And the key questions, I'm not going to tell you exactly my research questions, because then you'll have no incentive to read the journals when they come out. But more or less these three key ideas. What are the agendas of international donors at play in Palestine? What is the reality of the statehood versus population, occupation in the West Bank in particular? And what's the relationship between the state or the Palestinian Authority and the population? And all this we look at in terms of its impact on human rights in Palestine, norms versus practice. You know, what are international rights norms and what's the practice? And with that, I think that's it. So thank you very much for your attention.
That was Dr. Philip Leach, a senior fellow for the Center on Government at the University of Ottawa. Next up, we hear from Greg Elbo, a professor of political economy at the Department of Political Science at York University. He's currently co-editor of the Socialist Register. He was one of the panelists at a forum at Bates Atoon called Should We Be Talking About Fascism? Sadly, it was one of the last events held in their lovely Markham Street Community Center. Bates Atoon is now closed, and condos will go up where it used to stand. But it was a good wrap-up to a great place. Here's Greg Albo.
Thank you. I just begin echoing thanks to Bates Atoon and the great work it's done over the last several years of providing a space for us and selling really good olive oil and other things as well. It's been really terrific to have this venue, and it's going to be very sad to see it go. This topic, in one way or another, has been shadowed through a lot of the meetings here. Because of the importance of neoliberalism and the right over the last decade. Its ascendancy in different parts of the world. And to some extent, we are at one of those great historical moments where we have to think through and confront what is the balance of forces gathering on the political right, particularly when it's also a moment not only of weakness in capitalism, but of defeated working classes around the world, a great deal of problems for the capitalist classes to reorganize the economy and find an exit out of the current impasse. And there is the general sense that has been spreading, seen particularly in the American election, but also elsewhere, of a sense of the limits or problems of the inabilities of democracy to address any of these things. Find an exit through them through democratic institutions. In the general sense, which political scientists like me have been calling post-democracy or this moment of non-democracy to try and capture this general alienation from the political system, and the notion that normal political processes are being able to resolve it, but not necessarily an exit being found in addressing those through different forms of mass organization, mass mobilization, mass forms of resistance, but these forms, particularly gathering on the right. Some of the ways that we're seeing this, of course, is the growth of all kinds of extremist behavior and actions in different parts of the world. From the anti-Roma attacks that have been occurring in Hungary and in parts of Eastern Europe, the couple between Islamophobia on the one hand and forms of Islamic fascism on the other, the organized paramilitaries that have been unleashed directly by the BJP in India, obviously, as we know, the kind of spread of really extreme forms of right-wing populism in North America, particularly south of the border, but of course Canada has not been insulated from those processes. The authoritarianism in Russia, the militarism that's been gathering force again in Japan, and so on and so forth. We could just keep going on and on, cataloging both kind of particular incidents of the spread of direct racist politicized violence, and on the other hand, forms of gathering forms of political right-wing movements on the other. So I think it's very important to take account of the different forms that the right has been mutating in over the last years, and where it's getting strength, and where it's actually penetrating state power. So I think that, you know, there's a couple of crucial questions to ask about the how do we kind of map the forms of the right today, the different ways that it has been organizing, the different complexions it has, how it's impacting the balance of political forces, what its organizational strength is, what's its range, where it's influencing mainstream parties and shifting the overall tenor of the political spectrum, such as we're witnessing across the state, where the mass mobilization of the Tea Party and then the Tea Party mutating into the alt-right has kept pulling the American political spectrum, which is already a heavily racist and authoritarian and militarist political complexion over the last decades, keep pulling it to the right. And the way that, you know, the fluid forms of nationalism and the right have been, keep mutating into these new political vehicles right now. Not all, in all cases are they stable. They're mutating into and entering into governments in some cases and so on. So I think it's very important that we kind of take this question very seriously and try to figure out what's going on, what kind of conjuncture we're at, and so on. I think initially we just need to set this in terms of a little bit the longer term trajectory of neoliberalism, particularly the way that the politics and the world economy have unfolded since 2008, the financial crisis in 2008, and the way then this has added to the authoritarian tendencies that were already present in neoliberalism going back to the 1980s. We are, you know, approaching now 9-10 years from when the economic crisis started erupting in 2007-2008. We're not out of those problems. We're still running different forms of an emergency economic policies to try to keep the world market going. This has led to and keeps leading toward different forms of intensification of austerity, which I'll come back to. When we look around the world market, there's very few exit signs that are present. Japan remains in a deflationary situation. Europe remains in a deflationary situation, and the problems of surrounding the euro keep getting worse. The BRICS countries, which were seen as a key point of counterpoint to the crisis in the West, are themselves in a deep crisis, particularly South Africa, Russia, Brazil. There's a little bit different setting in India and China, but relative to what they were, their economic situations have been, their growth rates have been cut in half, and their economic situations are much more severe than they were. The lone place that looks to have come out of the crisis somewhat better, but has then different registers of problems, is the U.S., which has partly been then what's been pulling the Canadian economy along as well. But these are not in any way historically strong recoveries, nor are they insulated from the general problems that we see of the world market in terms of relatively high rates of inflation, relatively high rates of unemployment, relatively low rates of growth, massive indebtedness, stagnant wages, and so on and so forth. All those kind of general problems we associate with this period of what people generally call a long stagnation or a long depression, different ways that were being used to reflect on this economic conjuncture. This economic conjuncture has been the economic space in which the new right has been leading some of the main orientations to what's an alternative from what the main ruling bloc is doing. That's evident in the American election, but it's also evident in a lot of other countries. And the alternatives are not coming in any way out of the working class or socialist movements right now, so far anyways. When we look at move from the economic sphere and consider the nature of the ruling bloc, I think this is important in considering also how we assess what the right is and where it's at right now. One of the interesting things or important things to account for in thinking about the way that this conjuncture is unfolded is that there's been almost no splits within any aspect of the power block. The capitalist class have maintained a pretty united front in terms of the economic strategies they've been endorsing. They haven't broken with neoliberalism. Different than the 1930s, they haven't resorted to protectionism, and they've been attempting to make different measures that would kind of protect the internationalization of capital across the world market in all its forms. They've been pretty strong in moving towards policies of permanent austerity and so on. There has also been, the same orientations towards neoliberalism. They haven't broken from neoliberalism, although there's some discussion of moving towards a more activist fiscal policy, such as we had in the Canadian election under Trudeau. But remember, this movement towards more active fiscal policy is in the context of very slow growth, and the modes by which the fiscal policy will be implemented are largely all those mechanisms that we associate with neoliberalism. Privatization forms, new forms of marketization, and so on and so forth. So they don't kind of break with neoliberalism in the way the modalities or the means by which it would be implemented. So far, there have been increasing tensions from different parts of the world market, between Russia and the U.S., between the U.S. and China in part, and so on and so forth. But there has been no orientation to any of those zones to break the world market. So nothing quite like happened in the interwar crisis. The way that the tensions inside different zones of the world ended up breaking apart the world market. The orientation still, even if there are tensions between different zones that have been increasing, their orientation has not been to break apart the world market. It's to been finding to try and find ways to preserve it. It is an important consideration on the relationship between the U.S. and Russia is how much this has to do with the NATO pushing in new ways into the borders around Russia as opposed to Russia wanting to break apart or be isolated or have an alternative economic policy orientation in the world market. It's very hard to see Putin offering that kind of different orientation to the world market. This is particularly has to do with the U.S. geopolitical orientations. Two other characteristics I think that are important about the general power block in this is that the U.S. has remained over this period still the economically dominant center of the world. There is no rival to it yet. There's nothing like the rivalry or the relatively equal rivalries or the decline of one power and the rise of another power in the world market as occurred in the 1920s and 30s. There's no rival to the U.S. At anything comparable to that point in time. The U.S. is completely dominant military. It still is vastly the most important power in terms of per capita income and so on and so forth. There obviously is some shifting in geopolitical influence in different zones of the world, but the U.S. still remains absolutely pivotal. The other I think that's important in reading this period is how little social democracy is offering an alternative. It's not offering any kind of alternative perspective on economic or social policy or the world market to what's come from the right. The main social democratic powers, governments in power, are key players in defending this orientation in France. They're part of the government in Germany, the Nordic countries, the Democratic Party, the Italian government, and so on. They aren't offering an alternative. They are part of the structure of the power bloc in this, it's remarkable that we're into almost a decade since the crisis unfolded in 2007, 2008, and we still couldn't really identify what's the social democratic alternative to neoliberalism and finding an exit from the crisis. You can't identify it. So this is also part of kind of what's allowing the authoritarian tendencies within the present period to continue to develop, and you know, it's providing some of the political space for the right. When we look at the concrete form of the state and the way the state has developed over this time period, I think there's a couple of things that we need to identify. What we're still seeing is largely the intensification of the neoliberal form of the state, the economic policies towards marketization that have existed over the last several years. We have an exceptional monetary policy, too, the ZIRT or negative interest rate policies that exist in many parts of the almost all parts of the world, interest rates being very low, and the central banks doing a playing a large role in sustaining accumulation and sustaining investment. That is one aspect. The economic fiscal policy remains oriented to austerity. It has moved towards what often are called permanent austerity. A couple of years ago, the OECD put out a major study which framed its long-term thinking, just simply titled The Next 50 Years, The Challenges of Economic Policy, or something like that, some variation of that. And essentially they said, to get out of this crisis and solve it, we have to look ahead at 50 years of relatively strict fiscal policy restraint. So this long-term kind of orientation towards austerity is in place. One of the key things that has occurred is a defense in terms of economic policy is the defense of the internationalization of capital, the continuing movement and attempt to move different free trade agreements along. The one that just Canada has just signed in the process of signing with Europe, CETA, the Trans-Pacific Partnership with the Asian countries, with Canada and the U.S. Playing a lead role, the U.S. Free trade agreement with Europe, and so on. So that continues to be on the agenda. There are two other aspects that I think that are important to understand also in this period. There, across as part of the coordination in dealing with the crisis, the governments around the world, and particularly through the G20 governments, developed a number of agreements between them on how they would proceed to deal with economic policy and the problems of getting out of the crisis going into the future. These were various commitments they signed. The OECD then has been the enforcement mechanism, and then pushing each national government to live to follow up on them. And this was a commitment toward, they made something like 400 commitments to further marketization and flexibilization of the state sector. So around labor policy, consumer products, and so on and so forth. So they made a deep commitment towards continuing the neoliberal process and the reorganization of the state in that direction. The other thing that they did is they began coordinating through the OECD an orientation to what you can summarize as total privatization. That is, they helped guide all the OECD governments to take a total inventory of all their assets and begin a process of figuring out how to price them and how you could commercialize them or marketize them. So began a process of trying to totally transform the way that the state sector operated, even more in the direction of neoliberalism. Now, alongside that orientation towards sustaining neoliberalism has been another feature that has gone, that has been integral to neoliberalism over the last period. And that is, it has gone with the hardening of the state. Some of the things that Leslie will speak to, the deepening of the surveillance state, the restrictions on, various restrictions on civil liberties, the one area of the state where budgets typically have been increasing have been with the coercive apparatus of the state, the prison systems, the judiciary, the policing systems, and so on and so forth. Those have been the areas of the state which have been increasing in their portion of the budget, and so on. So we have this dynamic of the authoritarian tendencies that have existed within neoliberalism that have gone alongside the marketization and the building up of the free market being intensified. So that's the context, the general economic context that we're in. I think this leads importantly to the way then the ideological field has also shifted as part of this, of the as part of the process of dealing with the crisis, not just the political and the economic, but also the ideological field. One of them is a feature that I mentioned at the beginning, this general sense of being in an era where liberal democracy no longer works. This general kind of claim on the common sense that you can't change things, normal politics through normal democratic processes. But the response to that is not leading to massive new experiments on the political left. It's being particularly led by or providing space for political reaction on the right.
That was Greg Albo, a professor of political economy at York University. He was a panelist at a forum at Bates Atoon in Toronto called Should We Be Talking About Fascism? You've been listening to two presentations about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Thanks to Kavesh B for recording the talk in Toronto and to Octopus Books in Ottawa for putting us in touch with Dr. Leach so that we could run his speech as well. I'm Victoria Fenner. You've been listening to Needs No Introduction, Fresh Ideas from Speakers of Note, a podcast of Rabble.ca.